to call this meeting to order. Sorry, some of us were late. We had a leadership meeting here. Let the record show that it is about 13 minutes after 3 on February 8th, and the House Hess Committee now is called to order. I'd like to remind anyone at the testimony table, we've had reports that if we have to cough or ruffle papers too much, to please push this before you do that, so that if someone's giving a testimony, that blocks out what they're saying. So anyway, if any cell phones are on, please turn off your cell phones. And let the record reflect right now that Representatives Seaton, McGuire, Gardner, and myself, Wilson, are present at the meeting. And today on our agenda are three bills, House Bill 82, extending the Suicide Prevention Council, House Bill 105, Adult Dental Services, and House Bill 106, Senior Care. So just so everyone is aware, there will not be a public testimony on House Bill 105 or 106, and we will not be moving those bills out of committee today. But House Bill 82, we will hear that, and I do plan to move it out of committee if the committee wants to. So having said all that, let's have House Bill 82 before us, and Representative Nancy Dahlstrom is going to present the bill and answer questions. So
thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. It's a pleasure to be here today with you. Appreciate you bringing House Bill 82 for the committee today. This bill simply extends the Suicide Prevention Council until the year 2009. The council consists of 15 members that represent rural and urban Alaska. The Legislative Budget and Audit has recommended its extension, and this will allow the council to continue its mission of three things. Those three things are finding ways to reduce the suicide rate, broadening public awareness, and enhancing suicide prevention services throughout the state of Alaska. I hope that the committee will view this bill favorably, and I appreciate your consideration of it today. Thank you.
Okay, and we also have Janine Sparks, who's chair of the Suicide Prevention Council, online. And Janine, did you want to give any testimony? Hello, Janine? Evidently, she's not online. Is she? She's not there? Okay. All right. Okay, what about Kathy Kraft? She's statewide suicide prevention coordinator.
I am here. Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Kathy Kraft, for the record, and I am the statewide suicide prevention council coordinator, so I'm staff to the council. I work for the Department of Health and Social Services in the commissioner's office, and I live in Fairbanks. Representative Dahlstrom did a great overview of the council's intent, and if there, I have a few minutes just to go through perhaps a few of the goals and highlights of this past year. Is that possible, Madam Chair?
Yes, please go forward.
Okay. The suicide prevention goals for this year will be to broaden the public's awareness of suicide and the risk factors related to suicide, to enhance suicide prevention services and programs by aligning work with the Division of Behavioral Health, develop healthy communities through collaborative community-based and faith-based approaches, and to strengthen existing and build new partnerships between public and private entities that will advance the suicide prevention efforts in our state. The council is pleased with the audit recommendations to extend their sunset to June of 2009, because that will allow the council to continue the work that it started. And some of the things we have ongoing right now is a follow-back study. Some of the members of the committee may know that it's psychological autopsies. It's basically going back and gathering a year's worth of data on individuals who have committed suicide. After waiting an appropriate amount of time for mourning for the families, we ask them if they will be involved in voluntary interviews to gather information about their loved ones who have deceased. Some of the information that we're gathering is aggregate on suicide rates by age groups, the primary methods of suicide, females and males, documentation of substance use, ethnicity, urban versus rural, and then we also have regional data. We're also gathering information on suicide attempts. Last September in 2004, we released our statewide suicide prevention plan, and I have that available if there are any committee members that would like a copy of that. We also have started a media and public awareness campaign, Suicide Hurts, It Doesn't Have to Happen. And we are working on our clergy and clinician initiative, which would allow clergy and clinicians, professionals, to get together in different communities to talk about how they can work together on preventing suicides in their local areas. And then finally, our FY05 annual report to the legislature and to the governor is due March 1st, so that will be forthcoming in just a couple of weeks.
Okay, thank you very much, Kathy. And also, Kathy, we each on the committee have been handed your prevention plan. We have it in our hands right now.
Great, thank you.
And, you know, something that hasn't been mentioned today is that Alaska, per capita, is number one in the nation with suicides. And so that alone tells me that we've got our work cut out for us and that we really need to work on this. And so That fact alone tells us that we've got a long ways to go and that we should continue this program. So, Representative Gardner, you had a question?
I'm just looking for it. I thought I read something that we're second to Nevada, which sort of surprised me. Is that correct? And some of these materials here, I just read it a little minute ago.
Madam Chair, if that question was for me, I had a hard time hearing it, but where Alaska lies in the whether we're 1 through 10 is we range between 1 and 6, and a few years ago we were 6, and I think for this next year we will be rated 1, but I don't think that has come out yet.
Okay, thank you, Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions about the committee? Representative Seaton.
Yes, we had in our packet a Anchorage Daily News article on the audit. Would this be the appropriate time to ask that? Mm-hmm. In that article, it's talking about only about 20% of the $200,000 allocated to the council went to suicide prevention efforts. And one of the reasons was the Department of Health and Social Services spent about $32,000 of money on furniture for an unrelated program. Can you address that problem and make any corrections to that if there are available?
Madam Chair, this is Representative Dahlstrom. I would like to address that. Your point is well taken, Representative Seaton. There have been issues. They have been discussed with the Finance Committee members all individually, and they are prepared to address that issue in finance when they go through it line item by line item.
You want to follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I guess I'm just trying to find out, you know, from Hess's standpoint, we're looking at programs as well as the funding for the programs, and it seems like we need to be aware that of how this is going to be taken care of from the department standpoint, I guess, how they're going to address that. And if there's somebody from the department, I'd sure like them to address the future funding, not our funding of them, but their expenditures and how they will expend those monies and if there's some controls that have been instituted on that.
Is there somebody from the department that would like to address that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Hogan. I'm the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Representative Seaton through the Chair. There was a period of time approximately a year or so ago when there was a lot of changes going on within the Department of Health and and Social Services. We were going through a pretty major reorganization. At the same time, the Suicide Prevention Council lost their coordinator. She resigned to move back to Barrow. And there was a temporary or interim replacement by one of our staff members from the Division of Behavioral Health. When that person took on the responsibility, obviously one of those responsibilities was to determine how much money the council had available for the rest of the fiscal year. And I think primarily due to the reorganization, we initially had a hard time producing those dollars. And that's what became apparent or was pointed out in the legislative audit. I would say in retrospect that it was primarily due to the reorganization that the dollars that did not go directly to the council were used to support our integrated information technology efforts. And those efforts do support some of the activities and some of the work of the council. I will commit to you, and the commissioner will commit to you, that we will actively work with the council to ensure that they get more timely and accurate financial reports as we move forward. The Division of Behavioral Health and the Department of Health and Social Services is supportive of the council's activities. We just want to make sure that those activities are aligned with our community-based suicide prevention efforts, as well as our 24-hour psychiatric emergency services. So we are supportive, but we want to make sure that the activities are aligned as we move forward.
I do have a comment here. Now, can you, that all sounds nice, but can you assure us that a huge percent of the money will go toward suicide prevention rather than other things? Because here it says only 20%. And so we have, you know, if that's going to be, we might as well not.
Madam Chair, I can assure you that all of the dollars designed for the Suicide Prevention Council will go towards Suicide Prevention Council activities.
I guess that's what I wanted to hear for the record. Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Is there anyone online that would like to testify? Okay. Then hearing none, do I hear a motion from anybody in the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay.
With individual recommendations and attached, should be a fiscal note.
Yes, there is. It's on the tape.
There we go. Attached, showing zero, but I assume it's going to cost something. So attached fiscal notes.
Okay. So the motion is... House Bill 82, to move it out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Are there any objections?
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
I'd like to object for continuing discussion for a moment.
Okay.
On the fiscal note, can we get that zero fiscal note explained?
Nancy, would you like to come forward? And
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seaton, my understanding for the reason of the zero fiscal note is because the dollars are already budgeted in the governor's health and social services budget. So there isn't an additional request for funding. It's already been requested.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want to withdraw your objection?
Yes, I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay. Do I hear any other objections? If not, then that passed unanimously. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And House Bill 82 has passed committee. And make sure that everyone, before they leave the room, signs the committee report on that. Okay. That leaves us with next House Bill 105 and Adult Dental Services under Medicaid. And actually, we have a committee substitute for that bill. Actually, I sent the bill as drafted, the governor's bill, over to Ledge Legal, and there was a lot of recommendations that they had in that bill to bring it, just so that the statutes make everything clearer in the statutes. And I talked with the department on this, and We went over that, and so we agreed to their changes, the recommendations that they wanted in bill drafting. So I would like to have a motion to bring committee substitute for House Bill 105 before us.
Madam Chair, I'd move committee substitute 105 Hess 24 GH 108 1/G before the committee.
Okay, thank you. And that's behind tab 2 of your in your book. So what we'll do is we'll have the department come forward and explain the bill. Commissioner is here, so Commissioner Gilbertson, would you... do you need more chairs up there or anything?
I'll take it. I'll take it one step at a time. We'll see.
Okay. Just go forward then and explain to us exactly what this bill does.
All right. Just give me one second, Madam Chair. I'm going between two different things. I'm not sure if the right bill in front of me. First of all, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Joel Gilbertson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska. I believe on your agenda today, you actually have two bills that are governor's bills, House Bill 105 and 106. And these two bills, I understand that you brought one up, and I'll talk about one specifically right now, but just as a preliminary comment to the committee, these two bills, as far as our administration is concerned, are combined in one effort, which is a project that we as an administration and the last legislature worked constructively together on last year to establish a program called Senior Care for the state. And Senior Care undertook a couple of angles. First, and I think the most important thing, was to address the high cost of prescription drugs in this state. And we did that two ways, working constructively during with the last legislature. One was to establish a prescription drug subsidy for low-income seniors and to continue cash assistance benefits for low-income seniors in addition to the adult public assistance benefit. The second thing we did is work constructively to lower the cost of prescription drugs. One of the things we did was adopt a preferred drug list and develop consumer reports for seniors so they could see what are the lower cost drugs and drug classes. It's been a tremendous success for the state thus far. And also to look at ways that we can work as and through multiple states, using the purchasing power of multiple states. We were the pioneers with a couple other states to form the first ever multi-state prescription drug purchasing pool. And we did that last year, and that is allowing us as a state to negotiate better prescription drug prices for the state. And the last piece, which I think is one of the important pieces, is we established a senior information office. And for the first time ever, if you're a senior in the state of Alaska, you can pick up the phone and you can call our department and go on our webpage, and there's a link for Senior Care, and it has a toll-free number as well. And it ensures that any senior can call this and have trained individuals, regardless of who provides the program, be it the federal government or the state, we can provide one-stop shopping, so to speak, one point of entry for a senior, and they can find information on all of the programs that are available in both our state and the federal government. This is a big change, and it's very difficult for seniors to walk through the myriad of programs that we offer both stateside and nationally. How do they work together? Very complex. And also, what services are available is also pretty tough. And we all know about the challenge many seniors have faced finding a doctor who even accepts Medicare. Well, now there's a place where we can link up doctors who are willing to accept new Medicare patients and seniors who are in need of a primary physician who will accept Medicare as their insurance. So that's up and running, and it's been a great success. There are some changes, however, the governor is proposing in House Bill 105 and House Bill 106, and I'll start first with House Bill 105, are two pieces of strengthening senior care and strengthening this administration and this state's commitment to our seniors. We have a vibrant senior population in this state. It's still pretty small when compared to other states, but it's growing. And we know our services for seniors need to grow alongside that population growth. But we have some deficiencies in the services we're offering. House Bill 105, Madam Chair and Committee, is a proposal by the Governor to strengthen the oral health or dental services that we offer to seniors in this state who are low income. We've worked very constructively with the Mental Health Trust, and I think members of this committee remember probably a week and a half ago when there was a presentation before this committee regarding the Bring the Kids Home initiative. And that is a collaborative project between the Department and the Mental Health Trust to bring kids home from out of state. Well, that was the product of some pretty pretty aggressive and pretty substantial work that occurred between the Department of the Mental Health Trust and the boards over the interim between last session and this session. And from that, we came up with some focus areas for the trust to invest resources on. One was bring the kids home, but another area was around dental services. Currently under Medicaid, Medicaid coverage for adults, which we define as those over the age of 21, is restricted only to emergency dental services. And by emergency dental services, we basically mean dental services that are required to relieve immediate pain and acute infection. Overwhelmingly, this is when the individual oftentimes shows up in the emergency room and needs to have a tooth pulled. And we'll have the referral to the dentist and we'll pay for that. For adults, we do not pay for preventative services for dental care. So our seniors and our adults who are covered by Medicaid have no access to oral health care outside of an emergency setting where there's an infection or there's acute pain. We believe, as an administration and the Mental Health Trust believes as well, that this is a tremendous health care problem facing our state. Oral health care is an important piece of health care generally for individuals. There's been a lot of work of late looking at the interactions between health care and oral health care, general health care and oral health care. And we all know that we should be investing in prevention. And you've heard that many times, and I don't need to restate that today. But the proposed benefit that you'll see in House Bill 105 will allow us to cover under Medicaid coverage for preventative and restorative care. In particular, we were a little sensitive, and you'll see in the fiscal notes, which I do have somewhere here, you'll see that we were concerned about the pent-up demand that exists right now for dental services. We're very concerned about pent-up demand, which we know exists, because there's been such a large population out there that has not been receiving preventative dental services. And so we've worked with the Mental Health Trust to come up with a proposal on how we can ensure that we are able to provide services immediately, but also keep the program stable and sustainable long-term as we address this pent-up demand need. And so the benefit under this proposal in House Bill 105 is capped at a dollar amount on an annual basis, and that cap is at $1,150. I'm sure that raises a question, of course, which is how do you pick that number? And where does that number come from? We've actually have a chief dental officer for the Department of Health and Social Services. We worked with the Mental Health Trust. And what we basically wanted to ensure is that each year, over a period of 2 years, a senior will be able to purchase one half of a complete set of teeth. Tops 1 year, bottoms the next year. And this dollar amount, looking at the marketplaces right now, would allow us every 2 years to be able to purchase a full set of teeth for a senior in the state. It's kind of a strange way of developing a benefit, but we understand that there is this pent-up demand. It's legitimate. It's going to cause a lot of problems in the first couple of years, but we had to find some way to make this as a sustainable program when we start up this benefit. We have some examples of the services that would be available at that threshold at $1,150. That would cover one exam, four bite-wing radiographs, prophylaxis, the basic cleaning that they'll have on an annual basis, and about eight restorations and/or extractions. And then if you look at it as well, it'll also cover one exam and an upper or lower full denture, which is what I mentioned, being able to replace every 2 years the full set of dentures. As you'll see in the fiscal note, there are estimates for the number of individuals that we'll be serving. Right now, I believe we're anticipating that there is, and correct me if I'm wrong, John Sherwood in the audience as well, about 41,000 adults will be served. Adult? Okay, I believe the fiscal note. We'll get the exact number of the number of adults. It's important to mention. What do you need, John?
The fiscal note? It's on the back.
I was right. At 41,000 individuals that would be eligible for the expanded dental benefits. It's important to note that we're currently covering preventative services for children, particularly those served under Denali Kid Care or other Medicaid services. This really is a problem, the lack of preventative dental services for adults. That adult population does include non-seniors, those under the age of 65. But working through Medicaid policy, this is the best way for us to reach out and provide a dental benefit. Why is the Mental Health Trust invested in this? Well, this is a huge chunk of their constituency, individuals who receive beneficiaries of the Mental Health Trust. So as a result of that, what you'll notice in the fiscal note is that there is a commitment by the Mental Health Trust to fund a portion of the general fund match for the Medicaid services. We expect the Medicaid services to ramp up in 2007, largely because the senior care benefit is designed, I believe, and this benefit as well to kick in on January 1.
Final quarter.
So the final quarter of fiscal year 2006, the benefit will go into effect. The largest ramp up will be in 2007. And the commitment of the Mental Health Trust is to contribute in the financing and slowly wean off MTAR dollar support for this project. I understand it's largely a finance committee issue to how it will be paid for. But Mental Trust wanted to be sure we got this up and running and help invested with us to get this benefit going forward. But over time, the Mental Health Trust commitment to funding the general fund portion, or a portion of the general fund for Medicaid match will diminish. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Commissioner, I have a question.
Sure.
When I go to the dentist, when I go to a new dentist, which I did about a year ago, they took a lot more than 4 x-rays. I mean, it seemed like they were just taking nonstop x-rays in my mouth here, that there was just a lot of them. So this only covers, but it says bite wing, I think it said. That says 4, and I don't know for sure if that means they're extra big ones or what. I don't know, but I guess what I'm getting at, are the dentists across the state going to be informed at how much Medicaid will pay so they'll know to be careful about what they do? And
yes, and this heads into another area. I'm going to invite John Sherwood to come up here and discuss, which is how the prior authorization service works and how the dentist will have access to through the MMS, the point of POS system, which will allow the dentist to actually have access as they schedule the appointment to what the benefit and what the remaining benefit is. And so, John, maybe you can share that information to the committee.
Well, for the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Office of the Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services. I'm always a little bit nervous when I start talking about technical things. There is, under the HIPAA rules, requirements for electronic transactions to ascertain how much of a benefit or an authorization is allowed, and essentially obtain the prior authorization and approval to pay for the service. And I assume that this would be handled, we would handle it through this process. So folks, and we also have, for folks that don't do it electronically, we have other mechanisms that folks can call in and check on the status of a prior authorization to determine how much is available. I think most commonly, if somebody was seeing the dentist, they'd be kind of planning a course of treatment and overall know the benefits and be considering their treatment with that in mind.
I think
just to really summarize what John referred to is that for the vast majority of providers, their interactions around the claims processing and prior authorization system is electronic, the overwhelming majority. And as they schedule the appointments and as they seek the prior authorizations in that transaction, that the provider will have access to what is essentially the remaining balance, so to speak, of, it's almost, you can almost think of it as a debit card of some sort, since it's a cap benefit for the services. And as John mentioned, there are some still, not many, but there are some providers who don't use electronic interaction with the state in that, and for those individuals, they'd have to be telephonic as you set up the appointment and seek prior authorization for the service.
Okay, thank you. I'll let the record show that Representative Anderson has joined us, and also Representative Coyne and Cisna are on travel status and are excused. So, Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
Yes, I was just a little questioning about the pent-up demand, looking at the fiscal note. You know, it goes from one quarter at a little less than, $3.5 million, and then it goes to 11, and you go on across, and it's staying at 11 million, or pretty close to $11 million a year. Are we assuming that the pent-up demand is just that small increment above?
Response to the Sheriff's Institute, what you see in terms of the FY06 aspect of the fiscal note is the operating cost for running it for one quarter, because it won't be up and running until the last quarter of this upcoming fiscal year. You see the larger jump up to at fiscal year 2007, and that is by and large the annualization of that one quarter cost. We expect to have that pent-up demand for the first couple of years, and then we'll see in the out years it actually drops down a little bit, and then we start to inflate forward again. So we do think probably it'll be about 3 years for us to clear up at least some of the initial pent-up demand, and then we'll have a more traditional inflation factor on the program in the out years. General fund, of course, will continue to increase at a slightly higher rate because concurrently with the program growth, we'll have a diminishing of MTAR dollar mental health trust support for that match component of the benefit.
Follow-up, Representative Stevens.
Thank you. And are we making these calculations based on the 57% reimbursement or the 50% reimbursement from the federal government?
I believe the assumption in this fiscal note would be that approximately 66% of the cost would be federally funded, and that's a combination of the regular match rate and the match rate we would receive the 100% federal match rate for services provided through tribal facilities, which would be a significant portion.
Yeah, when we did the calculations, starting with the Chair, Senator Seaton, we did make, and I believe this fiscal note continues that, and it was certainly the last draft I saw, and I'll double-check this, but the last draft I saw during our calculations did assume the 50-50 match rate, I believe, unless it was changed last minute. I have to go back and double-check. But regardless, we're still going to have a blended match rate, and it's going to be far higher than that, simply because we have a large percentage of our claims volume that is delivered by IHS compacted providers, largely under ANCSA, the Alaska Native Health Corporations, delivering a large portion of that care. And as they provide services to a dual-eligible who's Medicaid-eligible and IHS-eligible, those Medicaid claims are processed at 100% reimbursement. I'd have to double-check with you. I apologize, I don't have an answer to that today. And we'll certainly have that wrapped up quickly. I'm sure the Finance Committee have the same question.
Representative McGuire.
Thank you. Commissioner, what I see in the CS, the only thing I noticed that's been added is page 2, lines 13 through 15. So a new, I guess, subsection B. And I just wanted to hear an explanation on the record. And that's just a definition of minimum treatment.
I have literally just seen the CS, so I,
okay.
I'm hoping John here can give you a much quicker answer than I can.
Yeah, I think this section refers to the kind of the base treatment, the treatment people are already eligible for, and as I understand the way this new section is supposed to work, it says that the limits that we impose under the previous paragraph don't apply to that emergency treatment of dental care, so we wouldn't somehow come in and inadvertently limit and restrict the care we're already offering to these individuals.
Okay, follow up.
Through the chair, yeah, that wasn't my question. I know what this section does in the original bill. I want to know in the CS why you're defining minimum treatment in the way that you are. That's the only substantive change between the original bill and the CS.
Yeah, I don't have the original
bill. I just
bill.
Wondered how you arrived at the definition and why you felt it necessary to include it.
I apologize. I don't have the history on why.
Nope. Kathy.
Here's the original. What new section is this? It's just B. B's new.
Representative Stevens.
Yeah, while we're getting information on that, could I go to a different question?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm having my staff go get the memo so that we'll know why we changed that.
It didn't come from the department, so we're trying to figure it out.
There we go. That answers it.
Okay. I assume that it's
legal. Another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, my question involves the access that adults will have to Medicaid dental facilities. We had a proposal from a community healthcare Native Association for a community clinic down in Homer. We have quite a few dentists my office called around to check to find out how many, because this is going to be under Medicaid, to find out how many dentists would take additional Medicaid patients. And basically, the answer was that the dentists that were had current Medicaid patients would continue, they would take no other Medicaid patients from any dentist that I could find in the Homer area. And so, you know, I wrote a letter recommending the approval of this dental clinic to be sponsored in there because there was no availability. So I don't want to get in the situation where we are telling seniors you have dental coverage and then no one will take that dental coverage because of the reimbursement rates or other facility or other reasons. And I know most communities don't have new dental clinics coming online specifically for this program. So I would like you to address the availability.
Sure.
Not just of the money, but what the facilities that will take this program.
Responding to the chair, Representative Seaton, the access issue around dental services is a legitimate one. It's a very legitimate issue, even for individuals who aren't insured by Medicaid. We've had access problems in particular around Medicaid, and I don't know if the Dental Association is here to explain their side of it. I don't want to speak for them, but we've had a lot of dialogue with the Dental Association to find ways that we can get more dentists to accept Medicaid. We still do have a number who do, but we have a number who don't accept Medicaid. Obviously, a large number of the clinics that are popping up all across the state are adding dental chairs. A large number of dental chairs are being developed in Anchorage. South Central Foundation has brought a large number on. Kenai, there have been additional dental chairs brought online. And they're accepting Medicaid. We're still going to have access problems. I've had a series of meetings with the Dental Association here in Alaska. They've raised a number of concerns that they've stated are reasons why they have thus far refused to accept Medicaid. Reimbursement has been an issue. That we've had clients that have not shown up for appointments has been an issue. We've had expressed to us a reluctance to sign the provider agreement that was required to be a Medicaid provider. I should point out, and I have pointed out to them, that the provider agreement is not unique to dentists. It's the same provider agreement that any provider signs. And we have not, while they've raised some specific concerns with the provider agreement, we have not had those concerns raised by any other provider group. And we've tried to address each one of those issues, even working with the Department of Law to provide advisory guidance that shows that some of their concerns are not consistent with the interpretation of the state house of that language. We've gone out of our way, I believe, as a state, to make Medicaid a good product in this state. Reimbursement's always going to be an ongoing challenge, and that's largely driven by the appropriation amount. And we can certainly raise the rates. We think we have a fair rate in Alaska. The larger issue is, and it's deeply rooted in your question, is as we're adding this benefit, with additional capacity coming online, but certainly not 41,000 capacity, are we going to be offering a benefit and not having complete access to dental chairs for seniors or adults who are receiving the service? And the answer is yes. It's going to be a challenge. We have across the state right now a number of areas where we are transporting patients for dental services. We've had really good response from Anchorage-based dentists taking Medicaid. As you get into some of the other areas in South Central, we've had difficulty finding providers who are willing to accept Medicaid and take on Medicaid clients and add them to their panel. And so we have transported patients, particularly kids, that's who we cover right now, we've transported them to Anchorage to go to dentists, largely clinics, but other providers, who will provide that routine screening and those periodic dental exams and to do some restorative work. I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge. We've had a number of meetings with the Mental Health Trust and with other stakeholder groups discussing this specific issue. I raised this issue a number of times. Are we just displacing clients and chairs? I think the only conclusion that we came to is that we're still going to have tremendous challenges. More capacity needs to be brought online. We've had dialogue with the Denali Commission on building more capacity in the state. Ultimately, we need more providers. more dentists, and more dentists willing to accept Medicaid. But we are going to still serve more individuals. That's why we're fiscal net here. Our projections and our analysis still assume we're going to have a large number of individuals afforded this benefit who are going to be able to get into a dental chair and receive services, often for the first time. But it's a legitimate question. I don't have a simple answer for you. Are we going to have individuals with this insurance product who are going to have a hard time getting into a dental chair? And the answer is yes, we are. We're going to be continuing to have dialogue with the provider community and to find other ways to bring capacity online to make sure that we can alleviate these access to care concerns, which are legitimate. I still believe that the governor's proposal is the right thing to do. We need to get the insurance coverage out there. We need to tell seniors in the state that we care about their, not just their mental health, not just their physical health, but also their oral health. And we need to insure them, and then we need to work constructively and simultaneously to get access into chairs. I think we have some capacity. We can deliver care now. That's what the fiscal net expresses. We will serve seniors, but the access issue is legitimate, and it's pervasive throughout dental health care services across the state, particularly in the rural regions. As trying to get providers has been a real challenge for the Native Health Corporations.
And I think if I remember last year, part of the problem was that one of the reasons many of the dentists have stopped seeing them is because they would make the appointments and then they wouldn't show up, and then they would have that, so they've lost what their productive time is just totally gone. They can't regain that. So that is a challenge maybe that we need to work on too, because that was a question or a problem I know in the past.
Madam Chair, as I said before, I won't speak to the motivations of dentists to or not to see a Medicaid client. I know that many of them have chosen not to see Medicaid clients. They have stated different reasons why they don't see Medicaid clients. Reimbursement's been raised, the provider agreement's been raised, clients don't show up, already have a full panel, prefer other insurance products, don't want to deal with the state. I mean, there's a whole collections of reasons. I know we've had dialogue with Senator Stevens in Washington. Senator Stevens has been very concerned about this, and he's been appropriating money on an annual basis to build dental capacity and to support the Native healthcare system of developing dental health aids. Mid-level professionals to do basic preventative screening work and some restorative work as well. And I think you're going to start seeing, based on some of the support coming from our senior senator, additional capacity coming online, but the challenge is not going to go away anytime soon.
I think Representative McGuire, you're next.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, Representative Seaton already asked my question, so thank you.
Through the chair, Commissioner, one thing just to file away at some point, I'd love to hear on the provider agreements. I know Senator Green put a bill into place a couple of years ago that impacted some of the fraud provisions and some of the abilities to kind of audit. And I think it's a good goal, but yeah. I've heard talk about that as well. And I'd be interested at some point, doesn't have to happen now, but to hear what specific complaints you have about the provider agreements, because that's something we could impact legislatively if there are parts of it that are particularly onerous that we might be able to change while still getting at the fundamental goal of preventing fraud. And then the second point, just another thing, when you're meeting with Senator Stevens or talking about these ideas, I've always thought, and it's kind of thinking outside the box, but the federal government should consider allowing tax write-offs for physicians and dentists that treat Medicaid recipients at some point. It's just something to think about. Again, it's the idea of kind of creating more incentives, but the fact is, for the reimbursement rate, that 1 hour of time that you have, you could be using to make a whole lot more money. And some people are motivated more by that. They have heavy medical school and dental school debts and things like that. But it's just something to think about. I know you're creative, and I know you interface a lot on the federal level. So
right. I'll be happy to explore that as well. I know that, Respondent Chair, I know that tax credit issues are very complex, and how that interacts with other aspects of reimbursement policy and laws is pretty complex, but I certainly will share that. Responding to your first question, I know that you couched it as at a later date, so I'll take you at your word on that, except to say that there was a bill passed, Senate Bill 41, for those who are following it, just the thing you're referring to, Senate Bill 41 that was passed, if I'm not mistaken, in 2003. It was passed by the legislature, which did mandate that the department must contract with a third party external to the state agency, Myers and Stauffer won that contract, to conduct 75 provider audits under Medicaid across a broad portfolio of services, not just dentists, not just any one type of provider. Those have been in effect now. We've been doing those audits, and certainly feel free to have a later date at the discretion of the chair to talk about what's come out of those audits and how that impacts other aspects. I think to some extent, just to state this, the provider agreement itself is an easy thing to talk about. I don't think that's the problem. That's just a piece of paper. It's what are you doing as an agency to support providers, and what are providers doing as a group to make sure we're increasing access to care. Provider agreement is what we all talk about because it's a piece of paper we can move around, but I don't think that's the problem. I think overwhelmingly it's reimbursement issues. Are we being responsive to providers? What are supply and demand, basic things that apply to healthcare just like any other economic system, and access to care is an ongoing challenge. Okay. Medical malpractice, with a whole lot of things out there.
Representative Garden, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. We learned recently that there's a new program for rural Alaska dental health care practitioners who could do cleaning and exams and basic fillings. Would those providers in rural areas be eligible to participate in this program?
Respondents could share, yes. What you're referring to is, it's actually not a state initiative, it's a federal initiative through Indian Health Service and with the Native Health Corporations in the state of Alaska. They are in the process of rolling out extenders or dental health aides who will be outstationed in the rural regions. They've been trained in all places, New Zealand, where there's a dental health aid training program. I had the good fortune in 2003, I believe it was, to take Secretary Tommy Thompson, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, out to rural Alaska, Wizard, Northern, and Shishmaref, and a few other places. He was given a presentation on the extender service, discussing the dental health aid program, training program from New Zealand. He was very impressed, but working through AMH, AMTHC, the Tribal Health Consortium, in Anchorage, Native Health Corporations, and Health Service are in the process of developing these mid-level professionals. This is nothing new. We use mid-level professionals all across our healthcare system in Alaska. And believe me, there would be no healthcare in rural Alaska if we didn't have community health aides and nurse practitioners and nurse midwives and the whole physician assistants and the whole collection of mid-level professionals. This is now an effort to extend that to dental healthcare services as well. There is some variety of issues that need to be worked out between the American Dental Association, the Alaska Dental Association, the Native Health Corporations, Congress, who's the entity that actually oversees this. There's a bill called the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act that was passed in 1976, which allowed for what you're referring to, which is the ability of Native Health Corporations and NHS facilities to bill under Medicaid. So they enroll as Medicaid providers and they see beneficiaries, largely Alaska Natives that are dual eligibles, so they would submit claims and we would reimburse, just like we reimburse to practices that have a physician assistant that delivers a service or a nurse midwife or any other mid-level practitioner. I think that there's a lot of dialogue going on right now, I know, as well from the Dental Association and the Native Health Corporation, look at ways, and the Dental Health Association sent up, the Dental Association sent up a group of dentists to Alaska, went out to rural Alaska last year and looked at the problem, recognized the problem, how we have a tremendous carry rate, children with cavities in western Alaska, and I know that they're also having dialogue with the Native Health System about how dentists can donate their time. They have a project that's being led by the Alaska Dental Association to find ways to have clinicians donate their time, particularly even dentists from out of state, looking at these licensure issues and various things, reciprocity, but getting providers out there. I think everyone agrees that there's a large problem. There's been a lot of dialogue about how to solve the problem, but the dental health is a portion of that, and they'd be able to bring in the system.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Yes.
Representative C.
Thank you. First of all, I am very supportive of this program. I just want to make sure. Now, you said that this would be for adults 21 and over. Does that mean that Denali kids will take care of up to and through 21?
Response to the chair, Representative C. What we really have is a gap. We currently are providing this service for children. We're just not providing it for adults. which are a separate portion of our eligibility population for Medicaid. So what this would do is basically bring adults up to the same, at least the same coverage options that are available to children as well. But unlike children, they live with this cap on how much we'll be able to spend. So there's still the difference between the way adults are treated and the way children are treated, but the children are already receiving a comprehensive oral health benefit under the Medicaid care and under Medicaid coverage for children under the age of 21. Really, it's this population 21 on that there's this gap, and so this is targeted to fix that gap, even though it's still not going to be as rich a benefit. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we weren't creating a gap in 21 or...
No.
Yeah. Follow-up representative.
Yes. Another question is, you know, as I explained, you know, there is basically no provision, even though there are lots of dental chairs and you can go in and see a dentist. I mean, it's not that they're all booked up down in the Southern Peninsula. Does that mean that for offering this benefit, we're going to see a large transportation cost? And have you built that figure into the fiscal note?
I think so.
Fiscal note?
You stole my fiscal note.
Yeah. You know, I don't believe that we factored in an unusual amount for transportation. Right now, the provision of dental services requires transportation, and my understanding was that was factored in, but I'm not aware of any special, addition we put in to have to transport people more frequently than we do now.
Yeah. And I look into that. I don't believe that the fiscal note needs to be adjusted for that. And any transportation services that are reimbursed, that's still done through the Medicaid program as well, so it's largely leveraged dollars, federal dollars. I'll look into that again, but I believe we did look at what our historic expenditures were and what we're spending on dental services and extrapolated from that around transportation as well, but I don't think we projected a large increase in transportation services. Of course, Medicaid is the largest transportation purchaser in the state of Alaska, which many people don't appreciate.
And Madam Chair, the reason why I bring that up is because in my survey of dentists, the ones that are taking Medicaid patients are going to continue to take those, but they won't take any new patients, so that anyone in the area under this plan basically would have to be transported out of the area because they're not, you know, it's a rough survey, but I mean that we call just about every dentist and, you know, in the area, and that was the response. So I just want to make sure that the department looks at that, and I appreciate you getting back to us on it.
Thank you.
Any other questions at all on that? Okay. My intentions on this bill is just to have it in front of the public today, and then at the next meeting on Thursday, we will see if we have any testimony, anybody that wants to testify online. So the reason we didn't today is because we knew that everybody would not have the committee substitute and before them. So for all of you out there who are listening today, the committee substitute now has been brought before us, and if you are wanting copies of it, you can call my office. Okay, is that it for this bill? So let's go to House Bill 106 then. It's under tab 3 of your book.
We're not at this space here.
I know.
Okay.
And in front of each person right now, each committee member, is the memorandum from Ledge Council on the bill. And there again, we went from her comments, got together with the department, and looked at her suggestions, and from there we came up with a committee substitute. So you each have the committee substitute in front of you. It's a committee substitute for House Bill 106, and it is work draft 24GH1090/G. And if someone would like to move to bring that forward.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt for discussion purposes the so referenced bill version.
Okay, and that was Representative Anderson. And we have before us now a community substitute for House Bill 106. And
Commissioner, if you will come forward and explain this. This is not going to be as easy.
Hey, give me a chance. And thank you again for scheduling this hearing. I'm always a little leery when we start to discuss prescription joint benefits, how many people I lose about 10 minutes into it, but it's a pretty complex issue. I started my comments when I talked about House Bill 105, that this is all part of a much larger effort by the governor and that was started with the previous legislature around senior care benefits for and starting a senior care program in the state of Alaska. A key piece of that is prescription drug coverage. We've all heard about the tremendous challenge seniors are facing across the state in being able to afford prescription drugs. Many seniors have to make that choice between the rent, the food bill, or perhaps even splitting prescription pills in half to make sure that they can at least take a portion of their prescribed drugs. Congress has been tremendously sensitive to the high cost of prescription drugs. Our governor, when he served as United States Senator, actually voted, I believe, over three times to establish a prescription drug benefit under Medicare. We were never successful, even though we voted a number of times to establish a prescription drug benefit. But nonetheless, Congress did act in the fall of 2003 to pass what's called the Medicare Modernization Act. And this bill had a few improvements in the Medicare program, but by far the most sizable was the establishment of a Medicare prescription drug benefit for seniors. And if you give me a little bit of indulgence, just so make sure we're all talking about the same thing, we're thinking of the same thing, because I know this has raised some questions in the past. Medicare is a collection. We talk about Medicare, but it's really a collection of programs and benefits. And what we're talking about around prescription drug coverage is called Part D, which begs the question, what is Part A, what's Part B, and what's Part C before we ever got to Part D? Well, Part D is the prescription drug benefit that was established by Congress in 2003. Part A and Part B are really the origins of the Medicare program when it was passed back in 1965. And Part A, which is run with a trust fund, and you pay your taxes and you kind of pay a stub towards Medicare, this goes towards insurance coverage for seniors for, obviously this is a gross generalization, but overwhelmingly this is inpatient care. This is when you show up at the hospital. And in the hospital, you have a deductible, you pay that deductible, but it pays for most of these facility-based services. Part B is optional for seniors. Most seniors enroll in it. They pay a premium. They have another deductible under Part B. And Part B is what most seniors are using, and that's the part of Medicare that pays for these outpatient services. Again, a little bit of a generalization, but when you go to see a physician in the doctor's office and he or she delivers that health care service, that's billed under Medicare Part B. Part C is actually overwhelming, I don't even have it in Alaska. Medicare Part C was originally called Medicare Plus Choice, and this was Medicare Managed Care. And there still are a number of outfits across the United States who provide where seniors enroll in these Medicare Managed Care plans. And instead of this sort of hodgepodge of programs, it's more like a traditional insurance product. And it has a capitated rate that's paid to the insurance company, and they manage the care and bear risk to provide health care services to seniors. This has been renamed Medicare Advantage now under the Medicare Modernization Act, but Medicare Advantage is still in place, we just don't have it in Alaska, and this is Medicare Managed Care. Part D is the new benefit, and Part D is to fill a gap. And the gap is that in 1965, when Congress first established the Medicare program, they did not include coverage for prescription drugs. Over time, there have been a couple drugs that have been covered by Medicare. Oral cancer treatments, for example, have been added to Medicare. Antibiotics for transplants have been, immunosuppressant drugs, I should say, for transplants have been added to Medicare. And there has been an effort to do piecemeal to add some prescription drug coverage, but by and large, Medicare has not covered prescription drugs, and seniors have been forced to bear out-of-pocket or through an employer-sponsored plan or through perhaps purchasing some type of supplemental insurance product outside of Medicare or perhaps as a Medigap policy, bear their cost for prescription drugs. Tremendous fiscal challenge for seniors. Congress acted in 2003 and passed the Medicare Modernization Act, created this new Part D benefit, which is optional for seniors. If a senior says, I don't want anything to change, I like what I have, I don't want change,
That's fine. We can stay in the program as currently exists. Medicare Part D is optional, and seniors will be able to enroll in it. And when they enroll in it, they'll have to pay a premium, a separate premium for Part D, and they'll have a deductible. For low-income seniors, below, I think, 100%, 135% of poverty.
Well, there's
I know, but I'm starting the lowest level. 135 is the cutoff.
For deductible,
right.
135.
Right. All right, just so yes. This is only teamwork, team building here. 135 and below, we are we're giving preferential treatment under the Medicare Modernization Act for those seniors, and the federal government picks up essentially the premium and deductible costs, and there is a higher cost sharing ratio. As once you pay your deductible and once you pay your premium, you're still going to have to buy your prescription drugs. And when you purchase that prescription drug and it costs $10, there'll be what's called co-insurance, where you will pay a certain percent and the federal government will pay a certain percent. For the lowest income seniors, the federal government will pick up a larger percentage of that purchase price after you've already paid your premium and after you've already satisfied your deductible. And there's a sliding scale above that. But what we do know, though, is for seniors above 135% of poverty, that there will be at least some portion of their premium deductible that will be covered. And for most of the seniors in the state of Alaska, they will have to pay for the premium and the deductible. And so the senior care benefit that was passed previously by the legislature, introduced by the governor last session, allowed us to continue cash assistance benefits for seniors below 135% of poverty. They received $120 a month in cash assistance. And from seniors 135 to 150 of poverty, we were providing a Medicare prescription drug subsidy. That benefit is due to sunset on January 1 of 2006, or when the Medicare prescription drug benefit goes into effect. The current plan is January 1 of 2006, but if it is delayed, these benefits will continue until that benefit goes into effect. The governor's proposal, House Bill 106, that is before you today, is for us to transition, extend, and enhance the prescription drug and cash assistance services we're going to be providing to seniors in the state of Alaska. And under the governor's proposal, for those up to 135% of poverty, they're the ones who are currently, seniors who are currently receiving cash assistance. Why cash and not prescription drug assistance? Well, because as I mentioned, under the federal program, they already do not bear any expense for premiums and deductibles, so we can't give them this benefit because they don't have that cost. So the governor's proposal is to continue the cash assistance. That'll be $120 a month, or $1,440 per year. The qualifications is that for that senior below 135% of poverty, that translates in terms of annual income for a single individual to just under $16,000, and for a couple to a little over $21,000. And there is a liquid asset limit. These are actually a little bit higher than the ones that we placed into effect with the last senior care bill. So it seems to be able to have a little bit more assets than they have liquid assets than they had before. The Medicare benefit will be extended to them, which is that their Medicare premiums and deductibles will be covered. So the value of that is about $670 per person. And they'll receive the full prescription drug coverage under Medicare Part D. We expect that we'll continue to serve roughly the same number of seniors right now, senior care in that demographic, and that amount is 7,000 seniors. The real expansion of the governor's proposal is for those seniors above 135% of poverty, but up to 300% of poverty. And for those seniors and under 300% of poverty, at the high end means for an individual slightly less than $35,000, and for a couple, it's slightly under $47,000, with a much higher liquid asset level of $50,000 for an individual, $100,000 for a couple. But we, the state of Alaska, will ensure that there's not going to be a senior in this state who's unable to enroll in Medicare Part D simply because they cannot afford their premium deductible. We fought too long and too hard as a nation to add prescription drug coverage to seniors under Medicare. We're not going to let the inability to pay that premium deductible, which is a real expense for a low-income senior in this state, prevent them from enrolling in that Medicare Part D benefit. So under the governor's proposal, we will step in and pay the premium, the monthly premium, and the deductible cost for those seniors. That's roughly a $670 benefit in the first year. They will then be able to get their Medicare Part D benefit as a result of having their premium satisfied and deductible. And our current anticipation is that we'll serve roughly 10,000 seniors, and we have a much more accurate breakdown of their actuarial projections in the fiscal note. The cost of this program is real. It's going to cost money, and the governor has put in his budget funding for this proposal. The numbers for fiscal year 2006 are initially could be quite low because there is still a balance in the senior care trust fund that was established by the legislature when the first senior care bill was passed, and this benefit will not go into effect until at the earliest January 1 of 2006, so it will only run for 6 months of the next fiscal year. We do, however, think that we should start acknowledging the high cost of this program going into fiscal year 2007, and so what you'll see from the administration is a proposal for fiscal year 2006 to pick up some of the costs and sort of forward fund on a rolling basis the cost of the program, and that's why we have a higher fiscal note for fiscal year 2006, even though theoretically, if you want to fully deplete the trust fund and pay only the minimum necessary, it would cost quite less in fiscal year 2006. The administration thinks that's irresponsible, so we decided to front fund the cost on a rolling basis. And Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions about either the fiscal note, if there's interest in the fiscal note through this committee, or the benefit itself.
Do we have any questions? Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
And Madam Chair, I'd be happy to, I know we do have some other charts here. If there's interest in us walking through some scenarios of what this means for certain types of seniors, we can do that as well.
Why don't we just go ahead and do
okay,
that?
Okay, certainly. First of all, this next chart, which I think have been provided as handouts for the committee and for the folks in the audience, but this shows you this real comparison between the old senior care benefit and the new senior care benefit as proposed by the governor. John Sherwood does a tremendous job trying to do the work on calculating the fiscal notes and really understanding how these programs work, and so we really struggled with this chart because we're purchasing different things, whereas all the dollars went towards the drug subsidy in the old senior care proposal because there was no premium deductible, and under the new program there will be a premium deductible, so there will be out-of-pocket expense that doesn't actually purchase drugs, it purchases your access to the insurance product. We did have a little bit of apples and oranges in this comparison, but nonetheless, this really looks at out-of-pocket expense towards drug expenses, but perhaps not actually purchasing a prescription drug. Under the old senior care benefit, and this is for seniors above 135% up to 150% of poverty, we were providing $1,000 of drug subsidies, which means for that senior, if they had $2,500 of drug costs, they would be out of pocket for $1,500. Under the governor's new proposal that's before this body as House Bill 106, for those individuals who have, again, that high drug cost, which is not that atypical, this is a high drug cost senior, but there are many of them, that out-of-pocket expense will be drastically reduced to only $457. Still, there's some out-of-pocket expense, but really increases and enriches the benefit for that senior. And that's really a combination of two things. One is the senior care drug benefit, which is shown in green. That's us paying the premiums and paying the deductibles. Getting that senior into a comprehensive drug insurance product, which is very important. We don't want seniors to fall through the cracks in the state. The second, which I'm not sure if we decided what the color was.
Purple.
We're going to call purple. That's the Medicare drug benefit. So that's the actual co-insurance or the actual percent of their drug costs that will be covered by Medicare. And then we have a little bit remaining of out-of-pocket expense. And Sherry, we have another chart if you don't mind putting that up there. Thank you. To kind of look at what does this mean for some typical seniors in this state? Because we will have to understand what does it mean for them. And so we found two scenarios. One is a married couple over the age of 65. They have an annual income of $42,000. They have assets that are below the threshold that we've established under the plan. And you have, in that case, perhaps the husband who has $2,500 in drug costs and the wife who has $1,500 in drug costs. What does it mean for them? Well, without senior care, which will be January 1 of next year, because we have a sunset in the existing senior care bill, without this new proposal from the governor, in that scenario, that couple will have to pay $2,403 out of pocket for prescription drugs. And that's money that's competing with their rent and competing with all their other household expenses. Under this proposal, we'll reduce that. got well under half, and that scenario, that couple, would only be bearing a little over 20% of their prescription, of their out-of-pocket expenses, and the actual out-of-pocket expense will be reduced to $1,000.
Representative Gardner has.
Excuse me, just a second. You made a reference to other assets.
Mm-hmm.
Are they defined elsewhere in the bill?
How about what accounts as assets? Liquid assets.
You know, in the bill, we and actually, it's the asset limits are not in the bill. They're established by regulation, so you won't see anything in the bill.
Okay.
But as we currently operate the program, and we tend to continue. We define assets as liquid assets. Those are assets that can be readily converted to cash within about 20 days. It would exclude home, car, personal property, clothes, those sorts of things. It would include primarily bank accounts, accessible retirement accounts, those kinds of things.
So, follow up. The couple here in the example could own a $500,000 home that's paid off.
That's correct.
Great and clear, and they'd still be getting this benefit. And okay, thank you.
That's correct. And that's actually consistent with how we've been currently applying our interpretation of what counts as an asset and what doesn't. We historically look towards truly liquid assets.
Okay.
Could you convert that to cash in a very short period of time?
Follow up.
I just find it a little troubling when they can have, you know, 300% of poverty defined, federally defined poverty level, and yet our Denali kid care for children who would have no other assets whatsoever have to have under 175% of poverty level. So it just seems to me that we're being far more generous with seniors than we are with children.
Response to the chair, there is no asset test on Denali kid care.
Right. Thank you.
So, in that extent, Denali kid care is more generous.
Representative Seed?
I guess I'm just trying to add, there's not an asset, but there is an income level on Denali kid care.
That's correct.
175% of poverty, isn't there?
That's correct. But there is no asset test.
Okay. Can you follow up?
Yes. Can you give us the amounts, 135% of poverty and 300% of poverty?
Certainly, I'm sure if you
or,
put,
or was that the...
It's on the first chart, and you should have one representative suit that looks sort of like this.
Right.
And it'll walk through the...
Okay.
In the left column, that'll be 135%. That's the high end, of course. And in the right column, that's the high end of the 300% of poverty. So the gap between the first column and the second column are those individuals that would have access to the prescription drug benefit. And those below the 135 would have the cash assistance. And on the last one, if you can put that chart up for one more second, sure, I apologize. We do have individuals, of course, seniors. We have many seniors who do live alone in this state. And so under a scenario, we looked at one woman in the state is perhaps 85 years of age, perhaps has $30,000 of annual income, meets the asset test that we've laid out, and perhaps has $2,000 of prescription drug expenses out of pocket. Without this benefit, and assuming she can pay her Medicare premium and deductible on her own, she'll still be out of pocket $1,108. That's if she can pay the benefit and get into the program. Under the senior care proposal, we'll make sure we can get that senior into Medicare Part D, and the out-of-pocket expense will be reduced to $438. Really strengthening the benefit for seniors and making sure that seniors in the state have access to prescription drug coverage.
Yes. On our comparison chart there's 7,000 under senior care cash assistance, and then there are 10,000 under... Are those additive? In other words, 7,000 plus an additional 10,000?
Responsible charts in the seating. Under that, I mean, these charts were used for broad audiences, so they were very rounded numbers. The fiscal note gets into the exact projections, but we are expecting to serve about 17,000 seniors. And we have a slightly over 40,000 seniors in the state, so our expectation is roughly 40% of the seniors in the state would be served in some capacity under the senior care benefit.
Okay, any other questions? I'm looking, Commissioner, at the memo from the Ledge Council,
mm-hmm.
and when we met with the department,
we accepted both, all of the first paragraph, all of the second paragraph, but can you give me, I think John probably can answer this, the rationalization?
On the public facilities, right.
Madam Chair, a rationale for excluding people in public facilities and certain other kinds of institutions really is we don't really want to duplicate existing programs. Right now, one type of public facility, common one, the correctional facilities, the state already pays for health care for inmates. In our Pioneers homes and in a veterans home, we have a payment assistance program, which essentially covers these sorts of costs for folks. To add this would require them to kind of do double accounting. And for our nursing homes, for folks who would qualify here, the overwhelming majority would either be excluded because they're already on Medicaid or be spending down their resources to qualify for Medicaid, and providing this benefit would sort of slow down their spending down to Medicaid, which would actually kind of delay them from getting a more comprehensive benefit. So,
And Madam Chair, we had this exact same issue when we passed the first senior care bill and had this discussion. You probably remember that. The way it was drafted was to be consistent with the way we resolved the issue in the last senior care benefit, which was to make sure that we, as broadly as possible, extended the benefit, but also did not duplicate a benefit that's already offered to by the state for those individuals who are in facilities, since we're already covering those prescription drug costs.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Yes, in the third paragraph, the second sentence there, where it's, if senior care benefits are intended to replace longevity payments, then conforming amendments. Did the administration intend this to be replacing the other payments?
Absolutely not. Responsible Chair, I'm seeing the program that we're providing services to is providing services to a whole host of individuals who are never even eligible for the longevity bonus program. In fact, as we started to look at the data that came back from the initial, just take a time warp back before we even got to the senior care benefit, we started something called the Alaska Senior Assistance Program, which was a $120 cash assistance benefit that was then codified in statute through the first senior care bill that almost every member of this committee saved for one passed in the last session. In that program, we started looking at the data. We saw that well over half of the individuals who were receiving the cash assistance benefit never received the longevity bonus. We're now using a means-tested program, and so we've moved away from what year did you become eligible towards, do you need the assistance or not. And as we've gone to a means-tested program, we're actually serving about half the individuals we were serving were never served by the longevity bonus program.
Any other questions for this bill? Okay. I guess you did a good job. Right now, then. Representative Seaton.
One more. On the from legal here, it says the appeals procedure on page 5, 12, 16 might be more appropriately placed in Department of Administration, administration hearing procedures. I know there has been several individual hearing sections in different departments that have now gone to the administrative hearing sections of the Department of Administration. Can you comment on that?
Sure.
Through the chair, when they created that that section in the Department of Administration, they did not include the beneficiary client hearings for public assistance programs for our department, and we prefer to keep our hearings together administratively within our department. There's already a process under 7AAC49 that sets forth hearing rights and processes, procedures for our assistance clients, and we just think it would be easier for the clients and for the department to administer to keep it all together.
And that, as John said, I'm going to restate what he said, and he did a really good job answering the question, I think. When that initial effort took place, there was a conscious decision not to include public assistance determinations, eligibility determinations. Those were retained inside the department, and we believe keeping this as well with that is consistent with how the previous situation was treated.
Okay. And I think, too, some of that is left over from the longevity bonus. That was in the Department of Administration, and now it's all into your department.
And the Department of Health and Social Services really never operated the longevity bonus program. The division that oversaw that program is a part of the Department of Health and Social Services, and that is the division that oversees the Pioneer Home System. So I think this may have been some, as the Madam Chair stated, this may be some leftovers from the belief that this was once operated by that department, but it never was.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess that's a different, if that's what this is intending to bring up, that's different than what I was bringing up. What I was bringing up was the fact that we've looked at streamlining and consolidation of appeal hearings throughout the administration. And I just want to get the clarification that we don't want to streamline or we don't want to consolidate those hearing procedures with what we've done all the way across the administration and combining hearings within this entire hearing section within the Department of Administration.
And that response from the Chair, Representative Seaton, the administration is very supportive of streamlining the hearings and appeals process in the state to not include this under the traditional hearing process that's in place right now in the department would be contrary to that. The public assistance, hearing determinations around public assistance benefits are handled in an integrated, uniform, centralized way through the Department of Health and Social Services hearing and appeals process. This is consistent with trying to keep them all together and not to create redundant hearing processes across the state government.
I guess that's all for today then. We will actually have a public testimony on Thursday on these two bills and also go on to look at my notes here so I can we're also going to have hearing on House Bill 95 on Thursday. Is that correct? You're all ready to do that on Thursday?
Fine.
Okay, then I will, our secretary today was Nikki Hughes, and our LIO person was Doug Lederman, and thank you for helping us out. And this committee is adjourned.